A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
So Daniel sent us this one, a data breach at Suno, the AI music generator that dumped millions of customer records. But here's the thing that makes it different. The hacker didn't sell the data, didn't demand a ransom. They handed it straight to a journalist. And what that journalist found wasn't just customer info. It was internal training code, showing the model was trained on scraped YouTube content, no permission asked. Which raises a question that's a lot thornier than how do we patch the server? When does a hack stop being a crime and start being a disclosure?
That's exactly the tension. And the early reporting on this is clear. The data went to a journalistic outlet, not a dark web marketplace. That alone tells you the motive wasn't financial, so we're not in ransomware territory. We're in something closer to, well, break into the filing cabinet and hand the documents to a reporter.
Which is why Daniel's asking us to get into the whole taxonomy of non-monetary hacking. Hacktivism, whistleblowing by way of intrusion, and whether any of it can be viewed as ethical. Let's unpack what actually happened with Suno first, because the details matter more than the headlines suggest.
Right. Suno is one of the big names in AI music generation. You type a prompt, it spits out a song with vocals, instrumentation, the works. They've raised something like $125 million in venture funding. Major record labels are already suing them for copyright infringement. And then this breach happens. Millions of customer records exposed, yes, but the real revelation was in the training code. It showed, pretty unambiguously, that their models were trained on fast scrapes of YouTube and other sources, content they almost certainly didn't have licenses for.
And that's the smoking gun the record labels have been trying to find through discovery. The hacker just handed it to a journalist.
And here's what makes this case so clean as an example. The hacker didn't deface Suno's website, didn't leak the customer data in a way that maximized harm, didn't demand policy changes. They targeted specific internal code that demonstrated what they presumably saw as corporate malfeasance, and they routed it to someone who could verify and contextualize it.
So the question sitting under all of this is, was this a crime? Was it whistleblowing? Or is it something in between that we don't have a good name for yet?
And to understand why someone would do this, we need to step back and look at the broader phenomenon of hacktivism. And it's not what most people think. The popular image is a guy in a Guy Fawkes mask doing a DDoS attack on a government website. That's one flavor, but it's a pretty narrow slice of what's actually been happening for almost two decades now.
Trace it back for me. Where does this actually start?
The modern hacktivism era really crystallized around 2008 with Anonymous and something called Project Chainology. The Church of Scientology had tried to suppress a video of Tom Cruise, an internal church video that got leaked. Anonymous responded with DDoS attacks, black fax campaigns, and eventually street protests outside Scientology centers worldwide. The motive was purely ideological. They saw it as a free speech issue, not a money-making opportunity. And that set a template.
So 2008 is ground zero for the idea that hacking could be a form of protest.
It's the moment it became visible as a coordinated tactic, but the motivations have diversified a lot since then. If you look at the landscape now, I think you can break non-monetary hacking into roughly three buckets. One is political protest, DDoS attacks against government sites, defacing official pages, that sort of thing. The goal is disruption and visibility. Two is reputational damage, leaking internal documents specifically to embarrass a company or organization, to erode public trust. And three is what I'd call corrective disclosure. Breaking in to obtain and publicize evidence of perceived illegality or unethical behavior with the goal of forcing accountability.
And Suno falls into that third bucket.
It's almost a textbook case. I've been thinking of it as evidentiary hacktivism. The goal isn't to disrupt the service. Suno's website stayed up, the music generator kept generating. The goal is to obtain evidence and get it into the public record. It's hacking as document production.
Which sounds a lot like whistleblowing, but there's a distinction you want to draw.
A crucial one. Traditional whistleblowers typically have authorized access. They're employees or contractors who see something wrong and leak documents they already have legitimate access to. They're leaking outward. Hackers are breaking inward. They have no authorized access at all. That distinction matters enormously, both legally and ethically.
Because the whistleblower didn't commit an additional crime to get the documents.
Right. The whistleblower may be violating an NDA or an employment contract, but they didn't break into a server. The hacker did. And that act of intrusion is itself a harm. Systems were breached, customer data was exposed, and Suno now has to deal with the fallout of a breach that affected millions of people who had nothing to do with the training data question.
That's the part that complicates the hero hacker narrative. The customer data exposure isn't collateral damage you can just wave away.
And we'll come back to that, because it's central to the ethical question. But first, let me give you a couple of comparison cases that help clarify what makes the Suno breach distinctive.
Go ahead.
Take the H.B. Gary federal hack in 2011. This was an anonymous operation against a security contractor. The CEO, Aaron Barr, had claimed he'd infiltrated Anonymous and was going to expose key members. Anonymous responded by hacking into H.B. Gary's servers and dumping tens of thousands of internal emails. Those emails revealed that H.B. Gary had proposed targeting WikiLeaks supporters, including plans to threaten journalists and spread disinformation. No financial gain. Pure political motive. The hack exposed genuinely troubling behavior that the public had a legitimate interest in knowing about.
And that's the case people point to when they want to argue that hacking can serve a public interest function.
It's probably the cleanest example. But then look at the Ashley Madison breach in 2015. A group calling itself the Impact Team hacked the infidelity dating site and demanded it be shut down. When the company refused, they dumped the personal data of over 30 million users. The hackers claimed moral outrage. They said the company was built on deception and charged users to delete profiles it never actually deleted. But the data dump included names, addresses, and sexual preferences of people who had simply signed up for a website. Some of those people lost their jobs. Some marriages ended. At least 2 suicides were reportedly linked to the breach.
So, same basic structure. Hack to expose perceived wrongdoing. But the harm to innocent third parties was massive.
And that's the spectrum. H.B. Gary Federal on one end. The harm was almost entirely to the company and its executives, and the public interest value was high. Ashley Madison on the other end, the moral claim was thinner and the collateral damage was catastrophic. Suno sits somewhere in between. The training data exposure has genuine public interest value. We're talking about potential copyright infringement at enormous scale by a company that's raised venture capital on the promise that its technology is legitimate. But millions of customers had their records exposed too.
So where does the Suno hacker's motivation fit? You said evidentiary hacktivism. But what specifically would drive someone to do this?
We can't know for certain without the hacker speaking publicly, but the choice of target is revealing. They didn't go after customer payment data and dump that. They went after the training code. That suggests someone who cares specifically about the AI ethics question, about transparency and how these models are built, and whether the companies building them are playing by the rules.
Which is an ideological motivation, not a personal grievance.
Right, and that's what separates hacktivism from revenge hacking. A disgruntled employee might leak internal documents to hurt their former employer. That's personal. The Suno hacker seems to be making a statement about the AI industry's data practices, and Suno happened to be the vulnerable target that proved the point.
There's also a strategic logic here. The record labels suing Suno have been trying to prove through discovery that the company trained on copyrighted material without licenses. Discovery is slow. A hack is fast. The hacker essentially short-circuited the legal process.
Which raises an uncomfortable question. If the legal system is too slow or too easy for wealthy companies to stall, does that create a moral opening for extra legal disclosure? I'm not comfortable with the answer, but I understand why someone might think so.
This is where we have to get into the ethics. And I think the way Daniel framed this, whether that action can be viewed ethically or otherwise, is exactly the right question. It's not, is this legal? We know it's not legal. The question is whether illegality and immorality are the same thing here.
So we've established the motivations. But the harder question is, does the motive justify the method? Let's wrestle with that.
Okay, so give me the frameworks. How do we even think about this?
There are two major ethical traditions that give you completely different answers. The deontological view says the act of hacking is inherently wrong regardless of the outcome. Breaking into someone's systems is a violation of property, of privacy, of the social contract. The consequences don't redeem the act. It's wrong in the same way that breaking into someone's house is wrong, even if you find evidence of a crime inside.
And the consequentialist view?
Says you judge the act by its outcomes. If the hack exposes genuine wrongdoing that would otherwise remain hidden, and the public benefit of that disclosure outweighs the harm caused by the intrusion, then the act can be morally justified. It's the greater good argument.
So applied to Suno, the deontologist says the hack was wrong, period. The consequentialist says, well, let's tally it up. On one side, we have a company that may have built a $125 million business on copyrighted material it never licensed. On the other side, we have a server intrusion and some exposed customer records.
And the consequentialist calculation gets complicated fast, because you have to weigh the harm to Suno, which, if they were actually violating copyright at scale, might be a harm we're less sympathetic to, against the harm to millions of customers whose data was swept up in the breach. Those customers didn't train a model on YouTube. They just wanted to make a funny song for their friend's birthday.
That's where the Ashley Madison comparison bites. The customers are the innocent third parties who absorb real harm from a hack that had nothing to do with them.
And that's the strongest argument against the Suno hacker, ethically speaking. If you wanted to expose the training data practices, you could have targeted just the internal code and left the customer database alone. The fact that customer records were also exposed suggests either carelessness or a willingness to maximize damage for leverage. Neither looks great.
Unless the argument is that exposing the full scope of the breach, including customer impact, is what generates the pressure for accountability. A quiet leak of training code might get buried. A breach that affects millions of users makes headlines and forces the company to respond.
That's a consequentialist argument, but it's a cold one. You're essentially saying the customers were used as a means to an end. Their privacy was sacrificed to create leverage. That's hard to defend under almost any ethical framework.
Let's talk about the legal side, because it's not just academic. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act in the U.S. makes unauthorized access to a computer system a federal crime. There's no public interest exception. None. It doesn't matter if you uncover fraud, corruption, or copyright infringement at massive scale. The act of breaking in is the crime.
And that's a really important contrast with whistleblower protection laws. Those laws protect people who disclose wrongdoing through authorized channels, internal reporting, inspector general complaints, congressional testimony. They don't protect people who hack into systems to find the wrongdoing in the first place. The law draws a bright line. If you had authorized access, you might be protected. If you broke in, you're a criminal, full stop.
Which creates a perverse incentive, if you think about it. An employee who sees something wrong and leaks, it's a whistleblower. An outsider who suspects something wrong and breaks in to prove it's a hacker facing federal charges. The difference isn't the truth of what's disclosed or the public interest value. It's purely about access.
And that binary is what critics of the CFAA have been pointing out for years. The law was written in 1986, before the modern internet existed, and it's been stretched to cover everything from serious intrusions to violating a website's terms of service. There's a long-running debate about whether the CFAA needs a good faith exception for security researchers and public interest disclosures.
But even if you added that exception, would the Suno hacker qualify? They weren't a security researcher doing coordinated disclosure. They took customer data and gave it to a journalist.
Probably not under any version of a good faith exception I've seen proposed. Security research exceptions typically require notifying the company and giving them time to fix the issue before going public. This was the opposite, straight to the press.
So legally, it's pretty open and shut. The hacker committed a crime. The ethical question is whether the law is adequate to the reality.
And that's where the concept of digital civil disobedience comes in. It borrows from Thoreau's idea that when the law itself enables or protects injustice, breaking the law can be a moral act. Thoreau went to jail for refusing to pay a poll tax that funded the Mexican-American War and slavery. He argued that complying with an unjust law makes you complicit in the injustice it enables.
So the digital civil disobedience argument would be, if the legal system can't effectively police AI companies' training data practices, if discovery is too slow, if companies can stall and obfuscate, then breaking into their servers to expose the truth is a form of conscientious refusal.
It's a provocative argument, and it's not entirely without precedent. Look at Edward Snowden in 2013. He was an NSA contractor, an insider, not a hacker. But the ethical structure of the debate is the same. He broke the law to disclose classified information about mass surveillance programs. The disclosures were illegal. They were also, by any reasonable measure, in the public interest. The debate ever since has been about whether the illegality of the act is the end of the story or just the beginning.
And Snowden's disclosures led to real change. Court rulings that parts of the surveillance program were unconstitutional, legislative reforms, a global conversation about privacy. The consequences were arguably positive, even transformative. But he's still living in exile in Russia because the law doesn't care about the consequences.
Right? And that's the paradox at the heart of all of this. The same act can be simultaneously a crime-deserving prosecution and a public service deserving gratitude. The law can't hold both ideas at once, but our moral intuitions can.
So let me push on the other side of this. If we celebrate the Suno hack, or even just shrug and say, well, they had it coming, what's the knock-on effect?
This is where I get uneasy. Because if you establish the precedent that hacking is justified whenever the hacker believes the target is doing something wrong, you've just deputized every person with a grudge and some technical skills. The standard isn't, did they actually uncover wrongdoing? It's, did they believe they would? And that's not a standard at all.
It's vigilante justice with a keyboard.
And vigilantes get it wrong all the time. They act on incomplete information, or they misunderstand what they're seeing, or they have motives they're not being honest about even to themselves. The rule of law exists precisely because we don't want individual citizens making unilateral decisions about who deserves to have their systems breached.
And there's a practical concern, too. If hacktivist breaches become more common, companies respond by locking everything down even tighter, which can actually reduce transparency. Internal discussions move to phone calls. Documentation gets sparser. The fear of being the next target makes organizations less transparent, not more.
That's the irony. The hack that exposes wrongdoing in the short term might make it harder to expose wrongdoing in the long term, because companies adapt by hiding things better.
Let's bring this back to the AI industry specifically, because Suno isn't happening in a vacuum. You've got a whole sector built on training data practices that are, to be charitable, legally ambiguous.
Hugely ambiguous. And Suno is just one case. You've got image generators, video generators, code generators, all of them trained on massive data sets scraped from the open web. The legal question of whether that scraping constitutes fair use or copyright infringement is still being litigated. The New York Times is suing OpenAI. Getty Images sued Stability AI. The record labels are suing Suno and Udio. These cases are going to take years to resolve.
And in the meantime, the companies are monetizing the models.
Right. They're building businesses on what might turn out to be a legal foundation of sand. And that's exactly the kind of situation that attracts evidentiary hacktivism. The hacker looks at this and says, the legal system is too slow, the companies are profiting in the interim, and the public doesn't know what's actually happening inside the training pipeline, so they take matters into their own hands.
Which makes me think the Suno breach is probably not the last one we'll see in the AI space. If anything, it might be the first of a wave.
I think that's right. And it puts AI companies in a difficult position. The best defense against this kind of hack isn't better cybersecurity, though that matters. It's transparency. If your training data practices are defensible, publish them. If you're not doing anything wrong, the evidentiary hack has no evidence to find.
But that's the bind. If your training data practices are legally questionable and you know it, transparency is a liability. So you stay opaque, which makes you a target, which makes a breach more likely, which exposes the practices you were trying to hide.
It's a doom loop, and I think a lot of AI executives are only now realizing they're caught in it.
Where does that leave us? Not with easy answers, but with some practical implications worth paying attention to.
So let me pull out a few threads for listeners who are trying to make sense of this. First, not all data breaches are equal. The motive matters enormously when you're evaluating the ethics and the societal impact. A ransomware attack that encrypts a hospital's patient records isn't the same thing as a hack that exposes corporate wrongdoing, even if both are technically crimes. The law treats them the same. Your ethical judgment shouldn't.
And for people working in the AI industry, what's the practical takeaway?
The Suno breach is a warning shot. If you're building AI models and your training data practices are opaque, you're carrying two kinds of risk. The legal risk from copyright lawsuits, and the reputational risk from someone deciding to make your opacity the story. The best defense against both is the same thing, transparency. Document what you're training on. Get licenses where you need them. Be able to defend your practices publicly, because you might have to.
It's funny. Companies spend millions on cybersecurity to keep hackers out. But the hack that really hurts them isn't the one that steals money. It's the one that steals their secrets and shows the world what they've been doing.
And for policymakers, there's a real question here about whether the CFAA and similar laws need updating. The current framework is binary. Access is either authorized or it's not, and unauthorized access is a crime with no exceptions for motive or outcome. That works fine for garden variety intrusions, but it struggles with cases where the intrusion reveals genuine public interest information. I'm not saying we should legalize hacktivism, but we might need a framework that can distinguish between the Ashley Madison breach and the Suno breach, because they're not the same thing.
The Ashley Madison comparison is useful as a kind of ethical stress test. If your hack exposes the private information of millions of people who did nothing wrong, the public interest claim gets very thin very fast. The Suno hacker is closer to the line than H.P. Gary Federal, but not as far over it as Ashley Madison.
And that's the framework I'd offer. When you're evaluating a hack like this, ask three questions. 1. What's the public interest value of what was disclosed? 2. How much harm fell on innocent third parties? And 3. Were there alternative ways to achieve the same disclosure that didn't involve breaking the law?
That third one is interesting. In the Suno case, were there alternatives? The record labels were already suing. Discovery might have eventually turned up the same evidence.
Eventually, maybe. But discovery in civil litigation can take years, and companies have ways of fighting it. The hacker might argue that eventually isn't good enough when the harm is ongoing, when Suno is out there monetizing a product built on what the hacker believes is stolen work. I'm not endorsing that argument, but I understand its internal logic.
So where do you land personally? Can an illegal act produce a morally good outcome?
I think it can. I think Snowden's disclosures were a net good, even though they were illegal. I think the H.P. Gary Federal hack exposed something the public needed to know, but I also think the burden of proof on the hacker is extremely high. You don't get to skip the ethical calculus just because you feel strongly about the cause. And the Suno hacker, by exposing customer data alongside the training code, might have failed that calculus even if the training data disclosure was valuable.
I lean the same way, but I'd add this. The fact that we're having this conversation at all is part of the point. The hacker may never be caught, they may never be named, but the questions they forced into the open, about how AI companies train their models, about who's checking, about whether the legal system is adequate to the task, those questions aren't going anywhere. And that might be the real objective. Not to win a legal victory, but to change the conversation.
Which is, if you think about it, the oldest hacktivist play in the book. Project Chainology wasn't about taking down Scientology's servers permanently. It was about making people ask questions they weren't asking before.
As AI companies amass more data under less scrutiny, do you think we're going to see more of these evidentiary hacks?
I think it's almost inevitable. The incentives are too strong. The legal system is too slow. The opacity is too thick. And there are enough people with technical skills and strong convictions about AI ethics that someone is going to decide the rules don't apply when the stakes are high enough. Whether we welcome that as an accountability mechanism or fear it as an erosion of the rule of law, that's the question we're all going to have to sit with.
And the answer probably isn't one or the other. It's both. The hack is a crime and a disclosure. It's a violation and a revelation. Holding both of those truths at once is uncomfortable, but I think it's the only honest way to think about this.
Uncomfortable is where the interesting conversations live.
And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1910s, a French geologist in Djibouti discovered strange glass tubes in the desert sand and declared them to be the remnants of ancient Roman glass factories. For over a decade, this was accepted as the explanation. It wasn't until a lightning strike was directly observed creating identical formations that scientists realized they were fulgurites, natural glass formed when lightning hit sand at temperatures exceeding 1800 degrees Celsius. The Roman glass factories of Djibouti never existed.
Roman glass factories?
In Djibouti, right. Thanks, Hilbert.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us a prompt like Daniel did, email the show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.